And welcome to The Source on KSTX, the product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. Social mobility, it's another way of saying the American dream. You work hard, you play by the rules, you will be rewarded with increased income and greater social standing. Your children will have a better chance. So they go to a good school, they can even do better than you did. So that there's new data that shows that upward social mobility in the U.S. isn't what it once was. It's harder to pull yourself up by those bootstraps. Joining us now to talk about social mobility, Nathaniel Hindren. He's an assistant professor of economics at Harvard University. And Joachim Singelman, he is the chair and dean's distinguished professor of public policy at the Department of Demography at UTSA. And we want to hear from our callers. Do you think that social mobility needs to be addressed? Have you felt that it's kept you haven't moved up like you thought you would have in life? How can it be fixed? Can people still make it up that economic ladder in America, or is that now an American myth? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. You could also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. Now let's welcome our guest, Joachim Singelman. He is at UTSA Department of Demography. Welcome to The Source. And also we have joining us from Harvard University, Nathaniel Hindren. Are you there, sir?
Yes, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let me ask you, Nathaniel, social mobility, how do we know that it's not as good as it used to be?
Well, I think, that's a great question. I think, I can talk a little bit about what we've been doing lately and has been getting some press is really focused on looking at the heterogeneity across the United States and the extent to which people are rising out of poverty. And I think what we've been uncovering lately is that there's just tremendous variation across the United States, so both within Texas and also across states, in the extent to which kids from poor backgrounds are able to reach the upper regions of the income distribution in the U.S.
So, Professor Singelman, you are at the Department of Demography at UTSA. Is this a homogenous effect, the fact of the lack of upward mobility, or is it hitting some parts of the population harder than others?
Oh, it's hitting some parts of the population harder than others, but let me also give you a little historical background. So during the period from about 1945 to 75, basically, the economy expanded. We had many better jobs than we had in the generation before. So upward mobility was easier in a sense because the pie got larger. And then after the oil shock, we had a real sort of retrenching period from 75 to the early 90s where wages stagnated, actually real wages went down. During the 90s, again, we had a boom period, and now we are sort of again in a period of stagnation. So in terms of mobility, it's harder now to be upwardly mobile because the good jobs are pretty much the same as they were earlier. So for someone to go up, someone else has to go down, and that's much harder to achieve.
But some countries are doing better at upward social mobility than the United States. Isn't that right, Professor Hindren?
Yeah, so if you look across the globe, you do see higher rates of upward mobility in places like Denmark and other places in continental Europe. But I think what was interesting from our perspective was that we found that some areas of the United States are actually just as good at producing, at having upward mobility as many parts of Europe. But what we also found was that some areas like the South, like Alabama, Georgia, so some cities in particular, Memphis, Atlanta, had lower rates of upward mobility. And so I think that what we really found surprising is that it's not only that we have low rates of upward mobility in the United States, which I think has been well known for a while now, but that there are some areas that just have much lower rates of upward mobility than others.
Now, is this because that people aren't participating in the American dream, or are they trying and failing?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. We looked at a bunch of different correlates to try to understand why some areas had lower rates of upward mobility than others, and I think this is some of the more speculative aspects of the work, but what we did find is that the rates of upward mobility were pretty highly correlated with things like the quality of the K-12 education system, measures of income inequality and segregation, the strength of social ties and the degree of civic engagement in an area, and then finally the strength of the family structure. So areas that had a greater share of two-parent households also had higher rates of upward mobility.
So, Professor Singelman, This is critical. I mean, we're not just this is an interesting intellectual exercise, but we're talking about real people, people's lives, and people want their kids to do better than themselves and to achieve a higher income and live better and have security. So, I mean, are you seeing this in your studies of demographics about how people are frustrated?
Well, I don't know if I've seen that they're frustrated, but we know from survey data people really want to do better. I mean, people have bought into the American dream. I did published a piece some years ago on the so-called culture of poverty. And the belief always was, and that's actually the belief that's underlying the Welfare Reform Act of 1996, that if you get public assistance, it makes you dependent on the government. And our findings were, and they're based on real good survey data, that even poor people say that if they work hard, they can get ahead. They believe it. But our research shows, and virtually everyone's research shows, that if you have sort of low human capital, you have a much harder chance to make it. So
low human capital would be like
low education, few networks, you know, networks with low resources, poor resources. So that the politically correct answer at that time was, yes, we believe in the American dream, but the social science correct answer is it doesn't really exist to the extent that people believe it does.
So this is having an American dream that is actually working and people have access if they try hard and they don't break the rules, they don't go to jail, they don't goof off all the time. Having a vital social mobility access is critical for just having a society that works well. I mean, I imagine, Professor Hendren, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And I think, you know, just the one thing to follow up on Professor Singelman's comment that I think was pretty important is that, you know, I think and I guess going back to the differences in variation, I think it's not only the case that we have very low rates of upward mobility in the U.S., but also going back to this variation, you know, one thing to mention here is that in say, Dubuque, Iowa, for example, if you're born to a family earning less than $25,000 a year, you have an equal chance of being anywhere in the income distribution as of today. Whereas if you were born, say, in the bottom portion of the income distribution earning less than $25,000 a year in say, Atlanta, you only have a 4% chance of earning more than $100,000 a year, which is the top quintile of the income distribution. And so what I think what we're trying to highlight is that it's not just that the U.S. is this kind of monolith that has low income inequality, or sorry, low intergenerational mobility. There are places in the United States that are actually pretty good at getting people out of poverty. And so I think what's important going forward is to really understand why those places have such higher rates of upward mobility so that we can try to replicate that across the U.S. as a whole.
We're talking about upward mobility in the United States, working hard and actually seeing some profits from their hard work and for your kids and your next generation. We want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. In the second half of The Source at 3:30, we're going to be talking about the Lisa Chan secret recording. Stay tuned for that. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. This is The Source on KSTX. We're talking about upward social mobility. We want to hear from you. The number to call is 614-8980. Our guest, Nathaniel Hendren, he's assistant professor of economics at Harvard. Joachim Singelman, he's a chair and dean's distinguished professor of public policy, Department of Demography at UTSA. Let's get to our phones. The phone lines are lighting up. The number is 614-8980. Clayton has been holding. Clayton, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I think that the reason we had a lot of upward social mobility during, it seemed like, the 40s, 50s, 60s, is because of World War II, when the common man, even though he might have been from poor circumstances, had gone to war and fought for the country, and even though his family might have been Italian immigrant, French, Irish, whatever, they were kind of homogenized by the war, and the common man was seen as a good guy. I think now the common man is usually perceived, they're lucky if they're perceived as the good guy, because the immigrants now don't look like what they used to. And I do believe that the powers that be in certain political, let's say what that political side of the fence, they do not ever want to have another president who's come from poor circumstances ever get to be in a position of power and authority. I will take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that call, Clayton. Some interesting points there. He does bring up the impact of World War II. Certainly, the GI Bill had a lot to do with economic mobility. And Professor Singelman, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think the GI Bill had something to do with it. It was also that I think labor was stronger, and there wasn't, on the part of management, sort of this let me get as much as I can. For example, in the 1950s, the average CEO of a company made about 20 times the average salary of the rank and file in his or her company. By 1980, it had gone up to 42 times. By 2000, it has gone up to 120 times, and today it is 204 times the average earnings. So we have seen a tremendous increase in inequality and, if you want so, in hollowing out of the middle class. And if the middle class becomes sort of hollowed out, it's harder to move into it if you're poor.
And Nathaniel Hendren, what do you think about the comment of the changing immigrant that we're having in the United States today? It seems like we're getting a lot of educated immigrants coming into the country, very skilled, and also we do have some low-skilled immigrants coming in as well.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And, you know, we looked at across the United States, looking at areas that had high versus low immigrant populations, and actually we didn't find much of a correlation between the fraction of people who were immigrants in an area and the rates of upward mobility. But we did find strong correlations with other things that people were mentioning, things like the size of the middle class seemed to be very important for explaining the variation and the extent to which people are rising out of poverty.
Back to the phones. Let's go to Mark. Mark, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I had a quick question. You had mentioned earlier about comparing different groups and assessing their ease of upward mobility, and you mentioned, you know, the assumption was they were, quote-unquote, following the rules or not goofing around all the time. My personal experience, although it may be limited, is that people who put in the right effort and dedicate themselves progress, and I'm just wondering, in those studies, how do you control for that? What do you look at to assess, quote-unquote, you know, play by the rules and not around?
All right, Mark, thank you for that call. And so, Professor Singelman?
I think people do play by the rules. I mean, you know, we are about 320 million people, and in all social classes you find people who don't play by the rules. But the vast majority want to get ahead. Immigrants want to get ahead. I mean, that's the reason why they actually left their country. They try to find an environment where they can do better. So poor people, rich people, people play by the rules, and then there are some outliers. And as I sort of thought about this topic, driving over here, it occurred to me that, you know, probably the damage done by a few poor people who don't play by the rule is probably less than if you're in power and you don't play by the rules. I mean, witness the economic disaster of 2008, 2009.
Right. Well, people are essentially rational beings, and they're going to do what makes sense for them. If they see that working hard, getting a job, being nine-to-fiver is a struggle and has no rewards, then they're going to be tempted to do other things and take those social shortcuts because it may be dangerous and, you know, run against a social structure, but it's profitable. So if by not having a upward mobility structure that is functioning, that's how you have a breakdowns in society. Professor Hendren, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's I would completely agree with that. I mean, I think there is this sense of a feedback loop. If you have greater social mobility, that has benefits from a perspective of, you know, gives kids an opportunity to work hard and actually, you know, achieve their goals. If they're in a structure where, you know, they don't have those opportunities, then it would make sense to turn to other means to get ahead.
Back to the phones. Caroline is on the air. Caroline, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. I just had a comment. I've taught at the community college level for many years and worked for a major corporation also. We have about a 40% dropout for high school in this country. Those that do graduate, many of them do not have any skill to sell in the workplace. You have to have skills or education or both to sell in our capitalistic society. And if you don't have something to sell and you're not putting tools in your toolbox, I don't see how you can have upward mobility unless you just happen to something wonderful and lucky happens to you. And so my concern is that we don't put an emphasis too much on people that aren't going to college, or we try to direct everybody to college when they don't need to be there. If they're there, they need to be in a skills program, not a four-year college degree program for many, many people. And I think we're losing out with those people because of it.
Right. So Carolyn, so you're a teacher and you see kids dropping out. And do you sometimes see this, that they may drop out because they don't see the point of putting in the effort today because there's no payoff?
No, I don't see that. I don't see it that way. I see a lot of kids that don't need calculus, algebra, 4 years of English and literature. I see kids that need to have skills in high school. I'm talking about high school dropouts. At the community college level, we have huge programs to try to get kids just up to a level where they could pass entry-level math or English. And so we're really missing out on helping people develop skills that aren't going to be four-year college graduates and don't even need to be directed. I love the European model, where you make a decision or that you're helped to make a decision at some point, and we're if you're not going to be on the college track, professional track, whatever you want to call it, then you are learning something that you can sell in the workplace, some kind of skill. And the large corporation that I work for, we went into the middle schools and started talking to them about jobs that they could have in the plant.
Okay.
We had 15-year-old people that were skilled people, and we couldn't see anybody coming up. So we were trying to get kids to go in and get some training so they could come to work for us.
All right, Carolyn, thank you so much. We appreciate your call and your comments. So she brings up a great point. You know, we do need plumbers. We need electricians, folks who can fix things. And you can do pretty well in those careers. And that is, that's social mobility, too, if you do well in that area. Professor Singelman?
Yeah, you do. The caller brought up some European examples. Probably the best one would be what's called the dual education system in Germany, where you become a certified apprentice. But that also goes hand in hand with additional education, as they are an apprentice. It's a continuation of schooling. We don't really have this here fully. But what she mentions were good points. A couple of caveats. The income gap between people with just high school education and college education is getting wider and wider. So unless we do something about those who only have high school education, the investment in college still pays off as expensive as it is today because of this widening gap. The second point about dropouts, we know from several educational studies that absenteeism in grades as low as 3 and 4 are a very good predictor of dropouts. So we could have tools if we wanted to intervene in this process. And thirdly, here in San Antonio, we are doing something really well, and that is we have voluntarily decided to pay a little bit higher sales tax for a pre-K program. France has demonstrated that of all Western European countries, it has the lowest link between social origin and educational achievement, and they have universal mandatory pre-K programs.
So, Professor Hendren, are there policies, economic policies in place in the United States that have broken upward mobility, and can it be fixed?
Well, I think that's a really great question. That is, I think, the important question for us in our future work, and we hope others will be aimed at that as well. I think at this point it's really too early to say whether we know specific policies that can really improve upward mobility. But what we do know are things like the quality of the K-12 education system. We know both that's related to the extent to which people are rising out of poverty across the United States. And we know from other independent studies that the local quality of the K-12 education system is very important for the long-run earnings of children, and in particular poor kids. And so I think that of the factors that we've been talking about a little earlier, certainly the education system, and this is what the caller was alluding to as well, the quality of the education system is really foundational.
But it does seem that we have a society that is, if once you get a drug offense, it's very, you can't get like certain Pell grants or low student loans. It's very hard to come out of that, and so we have a society that's not very forgiving in very ways. And once you mess up, your social mobility chances are very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think thinking about the right way to design those paths, especially for at-risk youth, I think that's one of the most fundamental questions here is to, you know, how much of an incentive do we need to be providing to sort of, you know, keep people on track? But for those people who have strayed from that track, what do we do to get them back on track? And I think there's some really fundamental trade-offs that really need to be understood.
And so Professor Singelman over at UTSA, what do you think people should take away from this if they want to apply some actionable information about, I want my kids to do better, what would you tell them?
Try to encourage them to stay in school. Try to, actually, most of them should go to college. The data is simply there. You make a better living. Try to help forces that want to increase minimum wage. If you work, you should be rewarded for it. And if you work 40 hours a week and 50 weeks a year, that's 2,000 hours, divide the poverty threshold by 2,000. That should be the minimum wage.
Right. So, Professor Hinderin, real quickly, very quickly, would an increase in the minimum wage be a something to help this area?
I mean, I think that there's trade-offs with a policy like that because you have, I think really we've got to think about this from a production standpoint. And really, I think the quality of education system is where I'd start.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for that answer, Professor Hinderin, Assistant Professor of Economics at Harvard, Joaquin Singelman, Chair of the Department of Demography at UTSA. When we're going to take a break, when we come back, we're going to be talking about the secret recording of City Council person Lisa Chan and about her anti-homophobic, her homophobic remarks, and is it fair to record people in secret that way? This is The Source on KSTX.